south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. All right, just to clear up a few things on what I actually feel about the COVIDiot stuff. Because, you know, emails have been trickling in, people saying, oh, Johnny, how can you make light of this terrible plague? And of course, we had Bart's email on the last show where he said I should stick to what I know, Latin American stuff, as if you know the COVIDiot problem has nothing to do with Latin America. Anyway, first of all, I'd like to repeat once again, I hate doing this. I hate when people throw out their credentials, especially when it's someone I like or admire. It grates on me. For example, I really like Gerald Celente. He's a card. He knows what he's talking about. But what grates on me is that in every single one of his interviews, he has to throw out a certain unimpressive credential. He says, you know, I was the assistant secretary of the so-and-so in the New York Senate, the youngest guy to ever hold that position. Well, you know what? Who gives a rat's ass? Hey, Gerald, I love you, but quit doing that, please. It's not becoming. So naturally, I hate throwing out my credentials too. But when people send me emails saying, I don't know what I'm talking about, stick to what I know. And because of my opinion on this COVIDiot crap, I do get emails like that. They are trickling in all the time. So in my defense, I have to play the credential card. I am a real university-educated biomedical engineer, which means I took loads of classes in biochemistry, physiology, biochemistry, virology. And well, let's just say I'm much better qualified to talk about this COVIDiot thing than the average slug. Now, I also have an electrical engineering degree, a satellite communications engineering degree, and a useless MBA. Full scholarships, graduated top of my class. So in the end, I'm slightly more qualified to talk about things like COVIDiot and things like crypto and Bitcoin than the average slug. That includes water purification, solar power, as well as dirty electrical radiation and EMPs. Well, I'll stop there, but I think you know what I mean. So to clarify my position on this COVIDiot thing, I have my own thoughts, and I have to paraphrase Gary Null, who's absolutely on the same wavelength. Starting with the fact that everyone's contaminated by fake news and the social media, especially Google, which everybody uses. And they own and control YouTube. Everyone worldwide uses that too. You know, Google's got a corporate rule that says you can't mention anything that's negative concerning the COVIDiot vaccines. And you can't mention anything that's contrary to the drivel that's being put out by that idiot Dr. Fauci. A guy who's made millions off of owning patents on vaccinations. Look it up, you'll see it's true. So then what about it? Well, yes, COVID's a real virus, and yes, it can kill people, but most everything else is BS. The figures of the active cases and number of deaths, bullshit, total lies. And now, after all that fake, scary data about COVID deaths and mortalities, the CDC has backtracked, saying that only between 6 and 9% of the reported COVID deaths are actually due to the COVID virus itself. You got that? Only between 6 and 9% of deaths. Meanwhile, for the last year, some countries have been reporting every single death as a COVID death. And that means it's not even a pandemic, just a slightly more severe flu season. If you don't believe me, check it out. You'll see they've been including pneumonia deaths and regular seasonal flu deaths as COVID-19 deaths. So how do you filter out the fake news? Well, you don't use Google. You use one of the other search engines that doesn't filter or censor results, like DuckDuckGo, StartPage, or the Brave browser. And how about that erroneous and sometimes completely false PCR test? The world uses that piece of crap to determine your mobility and lifestyle. It's hard to believe a test that unreliable is the corrupt government's ultimate determination. Whether you can go outside, eat in a restaurant, or travel, or have contact with normal people and have a regular life. Oh, and there's something else Google will block. If you mention that Kerry Mullis, the guy that invented the PCR test, a Nobel Prize winner, when people mention his quote that his PCR test should never be used as a diagnostic tool to determine viral activity in a person, if you say that in a Twitter or Facebook post, you're likely to get canceled or blocked. So here you have the guy who invented the test, got the Nobel Prize for it, saying his test will never prove you've got a live or active virus. It only detects pieces of a virus, any SARS-type virus that may have been there years ago. In other words, the test can't detect if you've got a live virus or one that you've had in your system for years and has been killed off by your own immune system. And you know, there are many, many types of SARS viruses, and that's the kind it detects. It can't detect one type of COVID virus from another. Do you know what the 19 means when they say COVID-19? That means it was first discovered in 2019. There have been many COVID viruses over the years, and that's how they label them. In fact, up to now, they've found 7 different COVID viruses that affect people. For example, there have been new COVID viruses in 2003, 2004, and 2013, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's that completely crazy multiplication factor on that PCR test. You know, in the lab, they can select a multiplier. And if they don't find virus particles at a 25 or 30 multiplication, that means you're absolutely non-infected and non-contagious. But if they pump it up to 35 or 40, which many labs do, some people will test positive due to old, dead viral particles left over in your system. But that doesn't matter. The law says you still get quarantined. But you knew that already, right? And all this BS about a huge amount of new cases or second waves. Of course, you're going to have tons more positives because there are tons more people getting the test done because so many businesses and institutions are now mandating it. So naturally, the positive numbers are going to be way up substantially over just a couple of months ago, back when hardly anyone got tested. So why haven't the media investigated this? Because the media gets its money from advertisers, and the biggest advertisers in the world, pharmaceutical companies. Duh. So face it, you're being lied to. Again, just like everything in life, including war, it's all about the money. Just follow the money and you'll see who pulls those strings. Oh, and here's something else new that you've probably never heard on the COVIDiot front. Did you know that those temperature sensor guns, you know, those infrared pistols that they use everywhere, don't work? They're absolutely useless when it comes to detecting if a person's sick or has a fever or even has the deadly COVIDiot strain. You know, there are tons of scientific papers on this, but let me read one that comes from the Florida State Public Health and Research Division of Florida State University. According to their research report and hundreds of others out there that somehow never get discussed on the lamestream news and never on Google searches. This article starts by saying, almost every health officer and researcher who's ever studied the effectiveness of infrared temperature-taking devices, as used in almost all businesses today, the devices only record surface skin temperature, not body core temperature. In other words, they do not show at all whether you have a fever or not, because a fever is an internal core body measurement. So they're absolutely useless in determining whether a person actually has a fever. Then it says, about the only practical use for these devices is plastic surgeons and dermatologists checking the health of skin grafts and various skin conditions. They do not measure if you are sick or not. Even more troubling, the report says, these infrared devices don't even accurately record surface temperatures, pointing out that they tested the most popular brands of temperature guns and show their readings on the very same surface can vary as much as 3 degrees Celsius or 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So just imagine a person's temperature could read 98.6, completely normal, with one particular company's infrared pistol device, and have another brand measuring the very same spot reading 103.6. with medical literature pointing out that any temperature over 103 is a serious condition. Are you getting this? The report goes on to say, even if thermal guns could check core body temperatures, they'd still be ineffective detecting COVID infections because a vast majority of people infected with COVID, that's 85% or more, show no fever at all. So then why do infrared temperature checks remain so popular and are practically everywhere? That in face of the overwhelming evidence that they just don't work? Well, for 2 reasons. One of them psychological. Part of it's the fact that businesses can feel like they're doing something to protect their clients against the virus, no matter how wrong-headed that might be. But most importantly, there's a huge economic factor. The handheld infrared devices are now a multi-billion dollar business that was nothing but a tiny little niche industry just a year ago. So then what are you going to do next time someone points one of those things at you? I'll tell you what I've been doing. I hold my hand up and make it into the form of a pistol. You know what I mean? And I point it right at the guy's face and pull the imaginary trigger, sometimes more than once. And then come the noises. Pew, pew, psh, psh. You should see the looks on their ridiculously masked faces. Try it sometime. It's fun. By the way, if you doubt any of this information, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll shoot you the links to these reports and articles. And now, a word about masks. Did you know the inside of your mask, after just 15 minutes of use, if taken to a lab and cultured in a petri dish, will show up to 700 different strains of viruses and bacteria? And when you're wearing a mask, you're trapping that stuff. All that growing in the nice, cozy, humid environment just a few millimeters from your cake hole. And you get to rebreathe that stuff endlessly. Isn't that nice? All right, now let's hit on something we discussed on the last show. The fact that generous gringos and expats who give gifts to their cleaning ladies, maids, gardeners, and maintenance guys could do no better than to buy one of those super high-efficient wood-burning stoves. Why? Because it'll cut way down on respiratory problems, and they burn less than half as much firewood. And you know, one of the biggest environmental problems here in Latin America is deforestation, which has three components: logging, the clearing of forests for grazing land and agriculture, and number three, probably the worst of it too, is the approximately 50 million or so Latin American families who buy, gather, or scrounge wood for their cooking stoves. Talk about air pollution. Anyway, after I mentioned that, I've had plenty of feedback from people saying, why don't we just hand out some water filters to all the poor folks? Because that really is the number one problem: contaminated water. And lower middle class and poor folks can't afford bottled water. That's why they're all loaded with intestinal parasites. So wouldn't that logically be the first step? Then later on, give them a high efficiency stove. After all, having clean water is a necessity. But you gotta think this through. The fact is, it's not a good move at all to buy your cleaning lady, maintenance guy, whatever, any kind of water purifier. Hey, don't think I'm nuts for saying that. Hear me out. You know, many gringos and expats, do-gooders, and church groups give away free water filters, and it just never worked. Problem is, after 6 months or a year, they're just not using it anymore. Chances are that new water filter is broke, damaged, or contaminated. I've seen many free water purifiers myself that ended up as decorations or flower pots. The problem is, do-gooders like to gift things to poor and indigenous people, and they don't think about the future consequences. Thing is, those water filters are easily damaged. You pour one Coca-Cola or some muddy water in the thing, and it's ruined forever. Now, water filters are meant to last a couple of years, but depending on what you put in them, like, for example, sludgy, silty river water, they could last just a few weeks. So anyway, over the years, do-gooder groups have given up on the water filter thing. Good intentions, terrible results. So that's the bad news. The good news is, there's a water purifier factory we visit at every Expat Insider seminar, and the owner, giving the tour, tells everyone how, by hook and crook, they conquered that problem. At first, they tried giving them away too, and that was a disaster. But someone in the company had the bright idea of giving free water purifiers to all the public schools throughout most of Central America. And of course, the teachers loved it because they'll tell you, one of the biggest cause of absenteeism is stomach problem. A lot of it due to bad water. So they have a little seminar first. They train the teachers how to use these purifiers. They install one in every classroom. And the teachers train up all the kids on how to use and maintain these things. Then, after some months go by, and the kids are used to drinking pure water for a change, and they start actually loading up empty jugs and bringing them home and showing their parents, because they can't stand the dirty water they're drinking at home. Besides, there's that extra step of boiling that water at home, and that uses firewood too. In the end, kids lose much less school because they're not sick, and the parents don't have to collect and burn firewood. So suddenly, those purifiers seem like a really good idea. And now, the whole family's clued in. So it doesn't take much to sell the parents on the idea that they need one in every home. So the kids pressure their parents, and the parents are put on a payment plan that's a year long at something like $5 a month. And man, that plan has taken off like wildfire. There are over 1 million of those units installed in Central America right now. They're in over 30 countries now, too. So anyway, that was a long version of why it's not a good idea, though your heart and your logic might tell you otherwise, to buy your cleaning lady a water purifier. It's much better to let the teachers at school get the ball rolling. Oh, and the other key to acceptance is not to give away that stuff for free. They have to have some skin in the game. So the Ecofilter companies figured all that out, too. They spread the cost of the unit, which is about $50, over an entire year. Hey, you know what happens when you give stuff for free. For a quick and depressing example, take my idiot nephew in Chicago, my namesake, unfortunately, John, a massively entitled child of the rich whose dad's a physician. He's destroyed no less than 4 late model cars, none of which he paid for. Every family's got one, right? Or 2, or 10. I know, it's not the kid's fault. It's always those idiot, indulgent, first world parents. Hey, but it's always someone else's entitled kid that's the problem, right? Never your own. Talk about blind spots, huh? Oh, and before, we were talking about deforestation and how 50 million poor and indigenous families in Latin America buy, scavenge, and chop wood daily just for cooking. Well, on that note, there's been so much worldwide do-gooder scrutiny and pressure regarding careless logging and deforestation. Did you know that in most Latin American countries, you can't even buy a chainsaw or operate one without a government permit? So when you're down here and finally homesteading, you can forget about jogging over to the hardware store and picking up a chainsaw. You have to jump through a bunch of government hoops to get it registered or face a big fine. But, you know, as with most things that are illegal or quasi-illegal or have to be licensed, people find a million creative and not-so-creative ways around it. So, as with most government laws that start out with good intentions, the permit issuing and registering of chainsaws has been sort of a fool's errand, too. So then you might ask, who gains? Well, only the government with fines and fees. In fact, I have here right in front of me, and I'll translate this, it's in Spanish, an application for a permit to possess a chainsaw. And this is from the government of Honduras Forestry Management Department. The irony being, Honduras is one of the countries that's got the most illegal logging in all the world. It says, the certificate of registration of a chainsaw to be used for legitimate purposes shall be valid for 2 years upon issuance, renewable for the same period, provided that the certificate of registration issued to a non-commercial orchard or fruit tree farmer or similar entities whose line of business or work is not related to wood and or timber production. For that, you need a separate license. So there's two different licenses. One's a non-commercial farmer license, and another if you're actually in the timber production or processing trade. And that license is valid for 5 years. Then it says, your certificate of registration shall serve as your permit to own, possess, and or use the registered chainsaw and must be in the possession of the chainsaw operator at all times. Now, it doesn't say whether you could hand that chainsaw off to one of your workers. I suppose you can, but who knows? Then it lists the requirements for getting that permit. It says you must have the official original receipt for that chainsaw. So, for example, if you're from the States and shipping a container down full of household goods and tools, if you've got a chainsaw in there, you better have the original receipt. But then again, there's always Photoshop. Then it says you must stencil the serial numbers of your chainsaw in large letters and numbers on the body of the chainsaw. And the cost? In the local funny money, lempiras, converted to dollars, about 12 bucks. And then it lists an estimate of the time it takes to get a permit. It says it takes 2 trips to the forestry office and about 4 hours in total. Yeah, right, 4 hours in the land of mañana time. That's what it says, but you know what that really means, don't you? Figure 8 hours standing in various government lines, dealing with various lard-ass government employees in different buildings. But here's the kicker. You don't need a permit for a regular handsaw with whatever size blade, nor do you need a permit for an electrical circular saw, you know, like a skill saw, or reciprocal saw, like a Sawzall, etc. And these days, now that most all power hand tools are battery-operated, if you had a decent Sawzall with a couple of batteries, you could drive into practically any woods and make short work of practically any tree without a chainsaw. So what we've got here is another case of pointless government bureaucracy. Oh, and by the way, if you get caught without a permit, it'd be anywhere from $100 to a $500 fine, depending on the country. Or more commonly, a $20 to $50 bribe. And believe me, illegal logging here in Latin America is extremely lucrative. Just one medium-sized caoba, teak, or palo blanco trunk can be sold on the black market for from $5,000 to $10,000. That's 2 or 3 years' salary for the average Latin American guy for just one night's work. But as they say, vale la pena. Vale la pena. It means it's worth the pain or worth the effort. All right, here's a question for you. How many of you listeners out there have an electric car? I know you're probably going to end up getting one someday, but do you have one now? Well, I'm starting to see them pop up here in Latin America. In fact, there are signs and billboards popping up all over the place with electric cars on them, with quite a few of them Chinese companies I've never heard of. My advice, by all means, get an electric car when you can. However, if you're down here in Latin America, you're not going to find many charging stations at all, so all you got to do is hook up a standard 220-volt dryer receptacle in your garage or your carport, whatever, and buy on Amazon a level 2 charger. Now, a level 1 charger is a 110-volt charger. You know, plugs right into a standard receptacle. But it'll take you forever to top off the charge on your car. Days. But if you've got just a standard 220-volt dryer receptacle, You buy a level 2 charger, something like $300 to $500. It plugs into any dryer outlet. It'll top off the battery in your car in 5 or 6 hours. Even faster if your electrician wires that dryer socket with a heavier gauge wire and a 50 or 60 amp breaker. Because normally you see an electric dryer breaker is around 40 amps. But beefing up that dryer circuit is not really necessary. And not to worry, even if your battery is almost dead, if you just charge your car for a half an hour, even 15 minutes, you can get 25 to 50 miles out of it. Now, I'm certainly going to get an electric car in a hurry as soon as they have an SUV out. Not that I love SUVs, it's just that they're high off the ground. That's something you absolutely have to have when you're down here in Latin America because of the potholes and the gigantic speed bumps and all that. So I'm waiting till next year when there's supposed to be 4 or 5 different brands offering small SUVs. However, it is true that traditional car dealerships up in the States will attempt to dissuade you from buying an electric car. They don't much push them at all. Why? Because they make almost nothing on parts and service because there's not much to go wrong in an electric car. No pistons, no plugs, no oil changes, no rubber seals or valves to get hot and corrode because there's no piston chamber with gas in it to explode or combust a la internal combustion engine. So the really great news is that though an electric car might cost 10 or 20% more than a regular internal combustion car, there'll be practically no maintenance except a brake job and the change of tires after maybe 40,000 miles. But that's true of any car. In the end, if you add up all the costs, you'll find your electric car will be much cheaper in the long run than any equivalent internal combustion car. And as for here in Latin America, even though electricity down here is much more expensive than it is up in the States, in the end, it's still cheaper to charge your car from the grid here in Latin America than it is to drive an internal combustion car because gas down here is also 1.5 to 2 times as much as it is up in the States. Even now, as I'm doing this show in February 2021, in many Latin American countries, gasoline's over $4 a gallon. Even in Mexico, where they produce gas and have huge refineries, it's around $4 a gallon. Meanwhile, I just looked up the spot price of regular unleaded gas. As it sits in tankers offshore, ready to be trucked to gas stations and sold, it's, get this, $1.25 a gallon. That means, for example, if gas at the pump is $4 a gallon, $2.75 of that $4 cost is government theft, taxes. So just remember that next time you're at the pump buying gas, it really only costs $1.25. The rest of that cost is Uncle Sam picking your pocket, as usual. All right, changing gears a bit. You know, in a past show, I mentioned that I had some really terrible jobs in my life. You know, I come from a family where you got a 25-cent allowance every once in a while, and that was it. So if you wanted dough, you had to go get a job. I started my first job at 12 years old with a Chicago Tribune paper route. I want to ask you guys and gals out there, if you've had a job that's crappier than the one I'm going to explain to you right now, the one I had for an entire summer between graduating from high school and entering engineering school, a 3-month job at the Chicago Street Department. I was the dead dog crew. You ever wonder who picks up those dead varmints? Well, in Chicago, that was me for a while. Now, it's definitely not something you want to mention to a girl on a first date. But at that age, a job's a job and you're making some dough. So anyway, my dad, who was connected to a lot of political guys in Chicago, got me this job. So every morning at 7, I'd head down to the street department lot, get in a dump truck with a guy named Joe. He was an old guy close to retirement. He'd drive and I was the guy doing the work. So we'd leave the yard every morning with a full load of cold mix asphalt. That was to fill potholes when there was a shortage of dead dogs. So anyway, we'd get a grouping of pink slips. Each one of them had an address where a dead dog was nearby. People would call them in, you know, because they do get pretty rancid and nasty looking after a while. So we'd pull up, I'd get out, take a gigantic plastic bag, put my arm through the bag and pick up the dead varmint and close up the bag around him. And then around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd drive about an hour way out in the county where the dump was, dump the load, and it was an hour back to the center of the city again. A nice 2-hour ride. Now, that's when I first got a hell of an education about government workers and unions. Let me tell you what we used to do for lunch. Around noon each day, old Joe would drive to what seemed like a different old neighborhood corner bar every day. We'd park the truck in the back parking lot, walk in, order lunch at the bar, and Joe would pound down 2 Boilermakers, you know, shot in a beer. And somehow, we never had to pay. And after a couple of days on the job, I said, Joe, I don't get it. He said, I'll tell you tomorrow. Now, the very next day, we pulled into the parking lot of another old neighborhood bar, where Joe proceeded to dump our load of asphalt. He smoothed it out with the Bobcat we were hauling in a little trailer behind the truck. Aha, that's when I realized We were fixing private parking lots to get unlimited free food and booze. Oh, and on really hot days, we'd pull into a bar parking lot on Lakeshore Drive or near it, go into the place, have lunch, and watch the Cub game for the rest of the afternoon. Again, eats and drinks on the house. Now, if you think that kind of stuff is just an anomaly, a one-off deal, well, my brother, who was also going to university, had a summer job that my dad hooked up for him at the Chicago Parks Department. And here's how his day went. He was on the line and curb painting crew. You know how every park has yellow or white lines painted on the curbs and lines painted in the parking lot. Well, every morning he'd go to the Parks Department garage, get into a little Jeep with a guy named Vito. Vito would drop my brother and another kid who had the same job as he did at one of 200 parks in Chicago and tell him which lines and curbs to paint. And Vito would take off. He'd completely disappear the rest of the day and pick him up at 3 in the afternoon. They'd go back to the garage and punch out. And eventually, when Vito got to know my brother, he told him what he'd do with his time all day. He'd go home to the wife, do some gardening, shopping, hit the dog track, watch the Cub game. In other words, the guy did absolutely no work at all. And that, my friends, was one of my early tastes of just how corrupt and lazy as so many government union workers are. Now imagine that happening in every large, medium, and small city throughout the United States. It's your taxpayer dollar at work and money right down the toilet. That's why when anyone tells me the answer to all the world's problems is more and bigger government, more departments, more control, more legislation, and bigger and more powerful unions, well, if it's worth my time and effort to make a point, I'll enlighten them with a few of those stories. But still, there's tens of thousands of retards out there just clamoring for the U.S. to have a national healthcare system. The thing is, just like socialism, in theory, it sounds like a great idea. But in practice, absolutely doomed to fail. Because somehow it seems it's human nature for a certain rather high percentage of people to loaf on the job or find a hiding place. And as long as they're in a union, they can get away with it. They almost never can get fired. But you knew that already, right? Oh, and don't forget, do tell me if you had a worse job than picking up dead, stinky, maggot-infested dogs for an entire long, hot summer. Can you beat that? Oh, and by the way, it wasn't only dogs. It was any dead varmint. Cats, possum, raccoons, deer. Even picked up a dead monkey and a gator. Oh, and you should hear some of the dead dog crew stories I have. If you want to hear a few mind-blowing stories, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and let me know. Or not. South
of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.